Welcome to Bio, a podcast produced by the Biographers International Organization. Bio is devoted to promoting the work of biographers and advocating for biography as a genre with the support of biographers and biography lovers worldwide. I'm Bio member Lisa Napoli. On each episode, we'll talk with the biographer about his or her work. Mary Kay Ash was the wildly successful and pioneering businesswoman behind the direct sales company Mary Kay Cosmetics. Even if you never purchased these products yourself, you might know that the top sellers earned pink Cadillacs. The details of Mary Kay's dramatic life offer a lens on a much bigger, decidedly American period in history. In the new book, Selling Opportunity, biographer Mary Lisa Gavinas paints a picture of a time when products were sold direct to consumer and women were able to take control of their financial lives by selling them. I asked Gavinas to explain the subject of her 15-year biographical odyssey, Mary Kay.
So this is the story of a girl who grew up during the Depression, got married at 16, had two babies by the time she was 18, became a grandmother at 34, and yet somehow ended up as the first woman to chair a company on the New York Stock Exchange and the only woman in Forbes' greatest business stories of all time. She had grown up at a time when there wasn't much of an opportunity for women to do anything. Think of the Tupperware era. Most people have some vague knowledge of that. So she had done direct selling through Stanley and a bunch of other companies for decades and decades. And then finally, she couldn't get ahead because they liked women to sell, but they didn't like them to manage. You know, at Avon, for example, the company for women, had no female managers at all. So she had many husbands. Mm-hmm. She was about to start her own company because one of her husbands had egged her into quitting where she was because he was out of work. So when she was 45, the husband, who she'd only been married to a month, dropped dead. And she was starting this company and had no idea what to do, pressed her 20-year-old son, who also hadn't finished college or had any real business experience, into being her second in command. And they started with a couple of people in this little storefront in Dallas, and it became a huge, huge direct selling company that's peaked at 3.5 million people worldwide. So direct selling is where you're not going to the store. You're just selling directly to the customer. So it's door-to-door sales, it's Tupperware parties, it's that kind of selling.
What's so interesting to me, and it was fun to read your book in the house with my almost 89-year-old mother, who remembers the heyday of all of this differently than I do. So, I mean, I think of Mary Kay and I think of the Cadillac and the prizes and all of that. Right. But basically, what's interesting to me is your book is not just the biography of this groundbreaking woman business person and what she achieved against all odds, but it's also really a glimpse into a moment in time in American history that just doesn't exist any longer, when people just shopped differently and we allowed people to knock on our doors, and the idea that we might buy something from them is just shocking too. So can you talk a little bit about why you decided to tell this story? It seems an obvious one now, but what compelled you, given your background as a journalist, to dive into this life story?
I was doing a book a long time ago called Color Stories, Behind the Scenes in America's Billion-Dollar Beauty Industry. Yes. And I did a chapter where I went to a Mary Kay seminar, which is a huge, huge production. It's like a Las Vegas extravaganza and a political convention all rolled into one. And I noticed that every place else I'd been, they talked about the product and how it was going to make the woman more beautiful. And they really weren't selling product there. They were selling self-confidence and enablement and, you know, opportunity, as I put it in the title. So I was very intrigued. I looked into her. She had this incredible rags to riches story. And I thought, oh, somebody will have written this. And Dolly Parton at the time had optioned the film rights or was trying to get them in development. And I thought, yeah, of course, somebody's going to write this. And nobody did. And I investigated it a little bit more. By the time that book was published, I was kind of amazed at how much hadn't been written about working class women and women during the Depression and women post-war and what they'd been through and the gender pay gap and everything else. We got a neat little wrapped up story of Rosie the Riveter and, domestic goddesses in the 50s. And it was left at that. And there was nothing about a sort of ongoing struggle for regular women. It just allowed me to touch on so many topics that nobody had touched on before. It was a great excuse. And I also saw in her a way to explore technical things as a writer that I really couldn't find in another subject. So that also intrigued me.
And how did you go about it? What was your methodology?
I took very much a journalist's approach because while Mary Kay was a public figure, it was the same story over and over again, and not necessarily did they all jibe. So what I did were hundreds, literally hundreds of interviews with people. I got a Leon Levy Fellowship, and I immediately started with surviving pioneers of direct selling, people who had been going door to door during the Depression, and interviewed them. Sometimes I interviewed them for days at a time. And I got that real firsthand account, a sort of Studs Terkel oral history almost. And at the same time, I dug through archives after archives after archive. And I say archives not because something was left. I'm talking about things where you go to a dusty old place in Houston where, there's a bunch of papers like stuck in something. And, it's the county, Harris County, what they call an archive, and you're going through that. There was nothing sorted. There was nothing digitized when I started. There was nothing really in libraries. There was no collection. So it was a journalist approach, just digging through documents, seeing what you find, seeing what turns up. And then the third thing I did that was also a journalist technique was just corroborating everything. People very often remember things differently, or they'll write something in a memoir that's somewhat self-serving. So I just talked to so many people to get their take on, what was that event really like? What would happen when you went in and started one of these parties? How were you recruited? How much were you being paid at the time? Just so I had a general sense and developed my ear for whether somebody was telling me the truth or not.
Now you glossed over something very important there, which is that you got a Leon Levy Fellowship, which is not something you just go get. So, and that's of course, and very prestigious, and you got it early on, I
Yeah.
think, in the
Yeah.
creation of those scholarships, which become more and more coveted as people know about it more and more, and more people get involved in biography. So how did you know about it, and what did you send that convinced them to award it to you?
I'd read about it in the New York Times because it was pretty hard to get it even then. And and it had been around for a little bit, and I went to one or two of their events to sort of scope out the territory because I was living in Manhattan. And their pitch at the time was to do something very different with biography. And I thought, oh, well, I've got something different. So I had a totally different subject. I had a totally different approach to the language, to the reporting, to the writing than traditional biographers had. So they went for it and took me at my word and gave me the fellowship. And it was a really great experience to have that luxury of having an office and being around other people who were having their own struggles with biography. And I'd say I probably, even though that was years ago, got 70% of the book done then.
Wow. The distillation of all of these source materials that you just described, including the fact that you were able to speak to so many people, takes years. And I'm always interested in these podcasts to, assuage people's fears who are taking a long time as they approach their subjects to synthesize it. So let's talk a little bit more about that. So you had that fellowship, and that was a big Kickstarter for you.
Yeah.
Obviously, you had enough done to get the fellowship in the first place, but then you were able to get a monumental amount of work done from there. And then what happened after all of that to the point that we're, about for you to launch the book for real?
Well, the God's honest truth is that what happened after that is a couple of things. One is I was a single mother raising a child in Midtown Manhattan and working two jobs in addition to writing this book. The other thing was when I would apply for other things, Mary Kay is a very polarizing figure. So people would just be completely disgusted that I had even asked them. I had
Other
one.
literary fellowships, you mean? The whole, is
No,
that what you're...
not just fellowships, but for example, I was at a Leon Levy event, and most of the people who were there who had had fellowships were pretty much in the finishing stages of a book or at least halfway through. And, we were having a little confab, and there was a literary agent there, and she learned that I was the only one who didn't have an agent, didn't have a book proposal ready yet. I was still at the beginning stages. And, we were having this long chat. She really liked me. She's going on and on. And I don't know what she had assumed that my project was, but she asked me, my subject. And I said, oh, it's Mary Kay Ash. And before I could even get into my pitch about her story and this being a contextual biography, I would never be associated with anything like that. And that happened to me hundreds of times. I mean, I had a second or third tier literary residency, not one of the big name ones, where I wrote to them and they said, just by email, my application was rejected almost immediately. Unless they really were speed readers, they could not have even read the whole thing. And then they felt compelled to add a little note to it saying, this is for real writers. That would happen just time after time after time. I think other biographers will run into this, and this is something that they might be interested in. People assume that a biography has either got to be a hagiography or a hatchet job. And they don't think that anything's going to be subtle, that it's going to be stimulating. And to me, the thing that I've always loved about biography as a genre is that a good one really puts you inside the skin of another person. You understand their times, how they lived. It's kind of amped up history. It's better than a novel because it's true. So when you have a really inspired one, you get to live somebody else's life without having to go through any of their drama. And most people don't think of it that way. There's a knee-jerk reaction to biography as a genre where, oh, well, I know what it's going to be about. Well, how? They don't know me. They don't really know anything about this subject that hasn't been written about before. So that sapped a lot of time because I kept coming back after each of those rejections. And they were mostly rejections. And then I also had COVID, and I also had my editor retire early. So, there were years in there where I didn't work on the book at all, to be honest. But, it's all good. I certainly have a perspective on the working women who are mothers and trying to find a way to support their families that I wouldn't have had back in the early days.
No, life intervenes, and it's always interesting to hear how it does and how we navigate it. And just as an aside, I had the same sort of snobbery and still do with Joan Kroc, the great philanthropist about whom I wrote a biography. People just poo-poo, especially in the publishing world. It's, McDonald's. Who cares about McDonald's? Fast Food Nation is one thing, but writing the history of McDonald's, which I really didn't intend to write, I had to write about Joan
Right.
Kroc. And to write about Joan Kroc, I had to write about the source of her fortune that she gave away. But so I relate to that, and I hope that whoever listens to this finds, it is sort of the reason why we have a lot of homogeneity in publishing, because it's a small group of people. But yet you got the Levy in the first place, which is amazing. I mean, it's an incredible honor to have gotten that. So they obviously saw in you and in the subject something valuable. A slice
Well,
of American history that's important.
and I mean, even now when I'm getting a great publicity rollout for this book, but they can't imagine that anybody would be involved with this or would examine it, or there could be any complexity to anything that happens to women or working class women or whatever. So it's the third rail as far as the subject goes, but yeah.
That is sadly disappointing and also sadly not that surprising, but good for you to have gotten through to the other side. And here we are now talking about it. And I'm just curious what happens next for you with this book and just in general.
Who knows what happens with this book? I mean, so we're talking before pub date, so I'm not sure. It's been very busy with a lot of things related to that. There are going to be excerpts running. But after that, to tell you the truth, it really depends for me on how it lands. I took so much out of this book for some of the companies that she had worked at and some of the experiences that she went through that I literally have enough for two other books that I just cut out of the main manuscript. I'm one of those masochists who enjoys cutting my own work. There's a prepositional phrase that doesn't belong there. Out it goes, But yeah, I have filing cabinets full of stuff because, as I said, most of it was Social Security records and, divorce records and alimony payments and, that kind of stuff. So I have a lot of it that I could be putting to good use. So I have two books in mind, both nonfiction, one's a biography, that, who knows what will happen.
Yeah, no one ever really does, but it's always interesting to me that some people think they do, and I always love to hear about it. So,
They're much more organized in their lives than I am then.
a big question that people ask is, how did you know it was time to start writing? So, it sounds like when you got the Levy, if we use that as sort of a line of demarcation, how much had you written at that point? And then in the aftermath, when was it that you knew was a good time to start writing when you had enough mastery of the subject and knowledge to do that?
I didn't wait for that. Actually, when I got the leave, I had to submit a writing sample, but what I did was sort of an outtake from the reporting that I'd done before. So in many ways, that was already written. I had supplemental material to submit for that, but the heavy lift was already done. And what I did, one of my organizing things, which I highly recommend to other people, was I kept in mind, because I'd published before, what's the flap copy for this going to be? What's the elevator pitch? What am I going for? So I started drafting that right away in my head. And at the same time, I think as soon as I trucked in some of my notes and took possession of my desk at the CUNY Grad Center, I started a chapter breakdown. So this is going to be in this chapter. This is what the arc is going to be. And I would fill it in as I went along. What ended up happening is by the time I left that fellowship, I had a really comprehensive several thousand words broken down chapter by chapter by chapter. So when it came time to do a chapter, all I had to do was select one, start filling it in, and amping it up. So what had started as maybe 100 words on what each chapter was going to be, by the time I left was, for some of those chapters was close to 1,000, 2,000 words, and I had a couple written. So yeah, it was a just sort of a gradual, it's like more like doing a painting. You sketch it out and then you keep filling it in and filling it in until the publisher grabs it from your hand and varnishes it and hangs it on the wall.
And that's where being a journalist comes in, I think, right? Because you're able to start at some historians or other people coming at it from a different direction might have a hard time starting with a nugget and expanding. But I can see how that would be natural for you. Not that it's easy, but that it's a natural organizing principle for you.
Yeah, the revelations, you have to meet your deadline, you think, which is ironic because mine went so long. But I highly recommend it because you can always switch to another chapter instead of just like waiting for it to go. And for me, to tell you the truth, the thing that took me the longest to write was the intro because, how are you going to intro this? Like, what do you want to say without making it too melodramatic? and not making it sound, as I said before, like a hagiography or a hatchet job.
Yeah.
So how to get people there and have a really clear-eyed intro. And also, I was very careful about the language that I put into the intro because it's very nonspecific when it starts. A girl grows up during the Depression. I wanted people to be able to project into her story that this is the story of millions of people, not just of her. Yes, she had a fascinating, very dramatic life. But yeah, ultimately, this is a story that's about so many other things.
Right. No, and that certainly comes across. It really is a great slice of history. It must feel good to be done, or does it feel weird to be done?
I'm one of those people that I go back and look at it and go, oh God, why did I put that in there? It's
Yes.
always, I'm never going to be, satisfied that I'm never going to think that that sentence couldn't have gotten better or, whatever. So yeah, there's a lot. It's interesting to see people's reactions to it too. What parts of the book they pick up on, and what they think. When I started this, nobody had written about direct selling at all, really. There had been a wonderful American Experience production from Laurie Kahn, Tupperware, where she talked about Brownie Weiss. And then recently, last year or so, it's become a cause célèbre, like MLMs, they're terrible. All these people are fools. They're falling for a pyramid scheme. For me, what I want people to get out of this book, I'm neither pro nor con Mary Kay or her company. I want people to come to their own conclusions, but I find it fascinating that people are going, oh, these people are all so stupid. They're just falling for it because they're poor and they're uneducated and we're going to save them. Well, these people might not have many other options. Some of them do, some of them don't. But what are they getting out of being in an MLM or an organization? They're getting something there that they can't get anywhere else. And that's a more subtle story and it requires more reporting.
The writer Mary Lisa Gavinas is the author of the new book, Selling Opportunity: The Story of Mary Kay, published by Viking on April 28th, 2026. We spoke via Zoom on Monday, April 13th, 2026. I'm Bio member Lisa Napoli. Thanks for listening to Bio.
To learn more about Bio or to hear other episodes in our podcast series, please visit our website, biographersinternational.org. Ellian Marie Fillinganes created our theme music. Jenny Skoog is our producer. Carolyn Van Putten, assistant producer, and Shereen Newman is our engineer. I'm executive producer Sonia Williams, and until next time, thanks so much for listening and have a wonderful day.